I'm going to be reading from a work in progress and from the very first chapter of an autobiography on which I've been working for a while. Kathy keeps asking me where I am on it, and I said, I've at least gotten out of high school. It's a long life. You know, Chaucer once said, life so short, the craft so long to learn. But in this case, the life is pretty long, and the craft can't quite catch up with it. In any case, the book is called, at least at the moment, and I think it will be that way because I rather like it, As If an Autobiography. And there are two epigraphs to the entire book, the first of which is, as if, it is all ifs. We are at much unease. Marianne Moore, Elephants. And the second is, as if life can be reduced to a narrative with a simple line. As if life can't be reduced to a narrative with a simple line. As if life is in any way a narrative. It's from one of my journals, December 28th, 1971. The chapter from which I'm reading, the very first chapter, is actually entitled, didn't quite work on the advertisement for the talk, but the actual title is They and There, The Right Side of the Tracks. They and There, The Right Side of the Tracks. My father read the newspaper from back to front, as if it were the Talmud. He read every word of it, though let me not be misleading, he was skeptical about the Talmud, without worrying about origins or the sense of an ending. He was convinced that wherever it started, whatever it was, it couldn't be trusted. No matter what was reported about it, there was nothing but thievery from beginning to end. But as though to confirm it again, the irrefutable, the inarguable, he read in reverse scruple, backing through the news. And if a story were continued, so what? He already knew the story, as he also knew the score. But he had to read it all, with headlines, subheads, captions, columns and other commentary, profiles, reviews, letters, stock listings and market statistics, the edgy ups and downs, as in the major league standings or shifting decimals of batting averages, comic strips and cartoons, the schedule of ship sailings, obituaries, classifieds, everything from the editorials to the finest print of ads, and in every section on Sundays. They're all the same, he'd say, as he closed the paper with a hard crease, front page up. He didn't care about a referent, they. The pronoun could shift all it wanted. He knew who they were. They were all the same. Hadn't he seen himself daily in the Daily News, biggest circulation in the country? Well, maybe not then, but soon to come as the other papers folded, the Mirror, the Journal, the Telegram, the Trib, only the Post left in the afternoon. You could hardly believe it today, but the Post, that virulent tabloid of the smirking right, was for the sympathetic left, or what passed for liberals then, a word more scarce at the time, or for those too politically pantywaist to be thought of as Trotskyite. Whatever you call them, you couldn't trust them. My father was a socialist, but he worried about them too, as he did about the unions, though he was a card-carrying charter member of Plumbers Union Local 1. Where we live, with a communist storefront in the neighborhood and recruiting parties on Friday nights, the daily worker was on the newsstand of the candy store downstairs. But you'd be hard-pressed anywhere to find the New York Times. And why would you want to? All the news that's fit to print, which my father was worthless too and not a picture on the page. That's, of course, changed today, and with color, no less, in the Times, a sort of plaintive washout of color, sometimes adorning atrocities, that as they replicate past the millennium, with no perversion, disease, horror, barbarity unimagined, serial killings, child murder, rape, ingenuities of abuse, not only familial and bureaucratic, but also priestly too, AIDS, genocide, jihads, and in the repertoire of the lethal, preserving virtue or power, amputations, beheadings, stonings, machetes in the Congo, and global weapons of mass destruction, biological warfare, and maybe even cyborgian, as well as the excruciating intelligence of torture never shown, recurrently makes me wonder how we read the news at all, which I do with the Times every morning, like my father, with the news, almost as compulsive, but going front to back, as if not wanting to escape the worst of it or what we're waiting for, like the inevitable news of a suicide bombing in a downtown shopping mall, and with the occasional feeling that in any direction, my father had it easy. Still, the fact of the matter was that he had it grievously right. Long before the absurd, none of it made sense. Nor was that an excuse, no more than it was in Beckett with his excruciating intelligence for thinking it might get better. Use your head! Use your head! You're on Earth! There's no cure for that! That outburst, over the years, I've often quoted from Endgame. So, if that's a revelation, what's new? My father would say. As for the news not fit to print, you might have found some of it back then, more of it now, though it's being printed, if you followed this direction. Over the Manhattan Bridge, left off Flatbush onto Atlantic Avenue, then straight out toward East New York to where the Long Island Railroad cuts below the street like a coronary bypass of the Jewish heart of Brooklyn. There was a bridge over the tracks, which I patrolled when in fourth or fifth grade at school. I was captain of the Safety Scouts. And with a quadrangular silver badge tilted in cusps snug around my arm, had a ritual fight with the leader of a black gang, or his surrogate, several mornings a week to keep things moving over the crossing. The martial arts were not on the scene, but there was a studied kabuki-like formality as the contest began, attaining in its repetitions, not irredeemably brutal, though it could be briefly fierce, a condition of equilibrium, thereby keeping the peace, which made more sense, at least, than the news as my father saw it. We usually fought in silence with a little crowd gathered around, either up on the bridge with its concrete walls or under the steps below. The black kids were usually more agile, but soon as I saw it coming, no turning back, I had a way of reaching out quick for a collar, holding on tight with the right hand, and punching steadily with the left, not down in the belly, but crack right there on the cheekbone or dead on in the nigger's face. And if the counterpunching was trouble, I was damn good at wrestling too, moving from collar to headlock and getting an elbow under the chin, either choking or jabbing with that when I got him on the ground. I must have done pretty well, because they never took away my badge, which I polished every day. It meant more to me, I think, than the gold medal the principal gave me at an assembly. I didn't know it was graduation for being the best student. It was not only embarrassing to be called on stage, but something of a surprise, because I was too busy fighting or playing ball to worry about studying then. Well, I must have somehow used my head, since I did get pretty high grades and was graduating a year early, having been skipped twice. My father, who was not given to bragging about his kids, not only watched me playing ball and now and then fight as well, but also saved my report cards to show around. As for the fighting, if my mother didn't like it, once coming after me with a broomstick and chasing me all the way up the street to make me stop, and he couldn't quite approve, he never interfered except the one time he grabbed me when he saw me backing away and pushed me toward a bully, a wop named Nucci, older than me, bigger, much too much of a match. It may have been because my father was there, but Nucci was so startled when crying at a rage and being forced to fight, I went with unceasing fury head first into his groin, grappling, butting, kicking, throwing punches wildly through whatever he did that he backed off himself. The turnaround would have been impossible without an accompaniment, of course. Cocksucker, motherfucker, shithead, Italian prick, the repertoire was endless, out of neighborhood fuck you contest, fuck you too, and up your ass, which you still can't print in the Times. But with the pedagogical dividend that came in later years. That was when, in the process of training the actors who became my Kraken group, I upped the ante on what they were doing by starting to curse them, way beyond any critical excess they'd encountered from me before. And then as they moved from being baffled to being pissed to being charged up enough to tell me to fuck off, I challenged them to summon up every dirty word they ever knew, turning them on each other, making up words if they had to, since most had deficient backgrounds, or dissolving them into sounds, fricatives, dentals, plosives, and every conceivable register are torn from the vocal cords, in what vocal cords assault unabating, letting the venom work. This was actually part of a series of exercises in what I called, in quite another language, the teleology of an instinct, starting the teleology of an instinct, starting at an extreme and letting it take you beyond exhaustion and psychophysical risk to what you otherwise couldn't imagine in some other zone of yourself. Sometime before that, in Paris, a far cry from Bronzeville in Brooklyn, but in this danger zone of the vocal, not so far as it seems, I'd been friendly with Roland Barthes when he was first moving from the pleasure of the text through the grain of the voice, the sort of deep-throated outburst through glottis, mucous membranes, spittle, nose, and teeth, to the notion of jouissance. The word is untranslatable, something more or other than joy, a certain exultancy and excess that before I read any text, I learned back there on the streets at the leading edge of performance, where as out on a football field, screaming your head off for motivation, you could also really get hurt. As for that graduation, with punches thrown and fuck yous, my grades were pretty good too. And if they wanted to give me a medal, they could have given me a medal for that. Meanwhile, I wanted nothing more than to be a football or basketball player, a desire that continued until I was nearly out of college. Better at those sports, but good at baseball too, I studied the moves, strategies, signals, subtleties of form with a conscientious passion that is required in the game. No excuses there, like making a double play, getting a pass to a spot, or blocking someone out, or in the knife-like instant not letting yourself be faked, may have spawned an attentive reflex that with part of me somewhere else, I also brought to school, along with a quick impatience for inaccuracy, cover-up, or those who, by goofing off, showed they lacked staying power. Down in the basement, laying pipes, those are qualities my father had, as everybody attested who knew his work as a plumber. Like him with an erring eye, I read the news backward then, but only the last few pages because that's where they had the sports. In the summer, with no floodlights in the schoolyard for night games and no television at home, I'd wait around the candy store, jumping over the Johnny pump or playing kick the can, till an early edition of the paper came. I may have heard the score on the radio or even part of a game, but I wanted to know it all in detail and with pictures, and they were great in the news, a full back page of often crucial plays. What I hoped to see most of all, and hear a betrayal, a Yankee fan in Brooklyn before the Dodgers betrayed it too, selling out to L.A. What I wanted to see most of all was an immaculate swing by Lou Gehrig, no doubt into the bleachers, or Lefty Gomez following through, going all nine innings, as pitchers were supposed to then, even with the advantage of being supported by the sluggers of Murderers Row. There was, as I imagined myself out there, doing what had to be done and knowing it had to be right, an accretion of discipline, not much different from what I later saw in the theater, where no matter what the talent, as coaches say in sports, a lot of it is mental. Or as Whitlow Wyatt, his pitching coach at Milwaukee, said of the Hall of Famer Warren Spahn, every pitch he throws has an idea behind it. And there was, to be sure, something obsessive about it, like the impossibly perfect circle that is formed by the actors' bodies was the unavoidably thwarted thematic and generative image of Elsinore, a work we derive from Hamlet, or the Hamletic disposition, that exorbitance of the mental, which in the imminence of perception failing is all the more possessed by thought and thereby keeps it going. From the morning, protecting the crossing till I fell asleep at night, rehearsing a marvelous steal or an inexcusably botched play, there was, even in sizing up cracks in the sidewalk for casually kicking the can, a sort of thinking with the body that also went to my head. But then so did certain images that, if congenital to the neighborhood, were out of another world. Like my grandmother putting a towel over her head on Friday nights and leaning over the Shabbat candles with a faith that was never mine and never meant to be, wafting up her nose the unassuming fumes. If that's thinking with the body, it's more like an outer body. And here, too, I learned something about credibility, as I later came to know it in dramaturgical terms, the appearance of a reality through the reality of appearance. Not believing what she believed, nor only believing that she believed it, I found myself believing, for the apparitional moments against all wish to resist, that what she believed was there. That short, unshapely, wispily white-haired woman, was it merely how she did it, a matter of performance? I couldn't have yet dreamed of asking the question, but some subliminal level was maybe thinking of that. I'm not sure what I was thinking, however, when one Friday night, in an early presumption of atheism or premature existentialism, I decided to put her on, laying out the proposition that God didn't exist. My parents were away, and Baba was making me dinner, indulging what was, in my rather slapdash demystifications, increasingly supercilious as she cooked and set the table. "Shah," she would say, "but that's it," until I said something that touched a nerve, when she suddenly turned on me with finger pointing and said with a whispered vehemence from the tautened orifice of her lips, "You'll see," and I thought Jehovah would strike me. What I said went out of my mind. I hadn't read Sartre yet or Nietzsche on God being dead. But even if I had, I've eaten my boiled chicken with Kishka and never brought them up. This was just about the time when I should have been bar mitzvahed. But it wasn't a matter of getting back at her with some assertion of bolstered doubt when it didn't happen. There was no refusal in principle, only the simple fact out of the same ubiquitous obsession that our ball games conflicted with lessons of the Talmud Torah. Even when they brought in a rabbi to tutor me privately, that often conflicted too. And since he was not the intimidating or brutal type you come across in Jewish novels, such as the relentless Call It Sleep, I gave that poor man such a hard time that he refused to go on. If I somewhat regret this now, with utter faithlessness as the bedrock of all I've come to believe, all the more through the intolerable prospects of the worldwide spread of religion, evangelicals, fundamentalists, faith-based initiatives, and the threat of non-secular states, it's mainly because of my grandmother, since it almost broke her heart. And she too felt that I was the natural scholar in the family and would surely thrive in Hebrew school. Herbalist, she might say, could even be a rabbi. The delinquency was all the more disappointing. Normally, Baba could absorb the very worst, or somebody's belaboring too much the unavoidable or unpredictable, with a shrug informed by the ages. "What can I say? It's all written," she'd say, long before grammatology and the writing in the beginning, which whether Derridian or Freudian was intrinsically Jewish too. And indeed, about my not coming to manhood through the ritual, there'd been some writing on the wall. For even when I went to the synagogue, which was only on holidays, I rarely attended the services, put off by the women caged upstairs and the prayer shawls and the snuff and the odorous murmurings below, the rocking back and forth of the men with beards and sideburns and phylacteries on their foreheads or wrapped around an arm. Even in a reform synagogue today, I feel discomforted, out of place, and want to leave as soon as I can. And that's what I did back then. There were, in a makeshift playground that didn't belong to the shul, swings and monkey bars adjacent to the building, and I either went out there or downstairs for the halva, strudel, and hazelnuts, with which we sometimes played games too, pitching them toward the wall, winner take all, the one whose nut gets closest to it in a wobbling final roll. As for the failure to get bar mitzvah, my parents didn't like it either, though they shrugged and let it pass. In my father's case, I suspect, because there was something more to it. With whatever residues or equivocations, his own lapse of faith, which didn't mean he couldn't be Jewish. Yet it was unthinkable, even when he showed my report cards around, that he'd introduce me among the plumbers as his Kaddish, even if I could recite the prayer for the dead, that would somehow assure through me, the one who comes after, something of an afterlife from him. "When you're dead," my father would say. Still, I wonder what he might feel about his being remembered here, or what, through memory or its lapses, I'm saying about him now, and whether I'm getting it right. Actually, I'm going to be saying a lot more about him, even in the latter part of the chapter, which I won't be reading, or whether he'd even know whether I got it right. My own sense is that if he had encountered the oracle's "know thyself," he wouldn't have known how to go about it. But then, with all the rites of memory, and on the current scene, therapeutically endorsed self-nurturing narrativity, which of us really does? As for the loss of faith, his or mine, it was not anything we talked about, nor did we ever discuss anything, either through his readings or an amorphous Marxism, like the philosophical grounds for it, just as he wouldn't discuss what it meant to have been thrown out of boys' high school, perhaps the best in the city, and the one I eventually went to. Turreted like a castle, a Romanesque conception built in 1891 with high academic ambitions, boys high, mainly Christian to begin with, was in one of the finer neighborhoods of the Bedford-Stuyvesant district, the not-yet-dreaded Bedford-Stuy, with its bourgeois brownstone houses. But getting there, when he went, from where my father lived, out beyond New Lots, where Whitman once lived in Brooklyn, was more than sufficiently threatening. What I did know is that he'd been suspended for carrying a gun, as others he went with did, because in crossing over the vacant lots, trash piles, and marshes to school, they'd often meet up with an Italian gang, which sometimes flourished guns, and in the tense encounters, the Jew boys felt they needed protection. On my father's side, he said, the guns were not even loaded, merely show, and because of that, on appeal, others were reinstated. But unfortunately, my grandfather, who had escaped from Austria and its virulent anti-Semitism, and lived first with a certain furtiveness on the Lower East Side, still had the mentality of somebody just off the boat. An illiterate tailor with no English, he didn't even know the appeal could be made, and thus my father was out. And besides, Italians for sure, but a Jew with a gun? Maybe it served him right. When I was secretary of the senior class at Boys and consulting now and then with the principal, Mr. Taus, he gave me access to the school records, and they confirm it as doubly sad that my father henceforth did his reading in private, as if it was somewhat shameful that he had to educate himself. However it came to be, it was just not in his temperament, even as my curiosity grew, to sit down with me and engage an issue out of his past. Even if I were up to it, I could never incite him to it. Intimacy of that kind was somewhere beyond the pale, and the same with emotional intimacy, at least as talked about. No therapy then, of course, which would have been, not only to him, something of a laugh. He had ideas, but whatever they were, he didn't talk about them either. About plumbing itself, no inhibitions. But as he was not inclined to speak out much at a union meeting, he was without the resources at home to explore what he thought any more openly than his gnomic statements about the news. Yet there was something poignant and even eloquent when on long summer evenings or walk weekend afternoons, he'd sit at the window wearing a tank top and stare out over the avenue as at some unfathomable emptiness. I hadn't yet encountered T.S. Eliot's Lonely Men in Shirt Sleeves leaning out of windows, or that other figure, Durantian, who speaks of the Jew lowercase squatting on the windowsill, with whom, through any semblance of anti-Semitism, he and Eliot seemed to identify. But my father, wearily, palpably, had something in common with this unappeasably convoluted, self-mortifying figure who didn't have the words for it. No less the word within a word, unable to speak a word, the night coming on, swaddled in darkness. There in the window, what did my father wish for? It may seem disproportionate, but many years later, teaching the poem in the class, I found myself thinking of that through the stunning passage about the complexion of history, its contrived corridors and issues, deceiving with whispering ambitions, and through all the vanities and supple confusions, giving too late what's not believed in or still believed in memory only, reconsidered passion. Or do I say this only because, having with some aversion done a dissertation on Eliot, I still think this is the finest passage he ever wrote, in the midst of predictable historicizing in our graduate schools today, where Eliot has been discredited, much closer to my own sense of history. However, that was acquired through a belated intellectuality or the vicissitudes of a complex career, it may also be in some respects unspoken, sequestered, what he thought, maybe emptied of thought, as in that perdurable image in the window, the intellectual legacy of my father, who was kicked out of my high school and more than wavered in faith. With or without faith, and unlike Gertrude Stein's Oakland, there was a there in Bronzeville. Though you may not have wanted to be there, even secure in faith like my grandmother, in the vicinity of where she lived, because it was turning increasingly black. This was in actuality the more dubious margin of Bronzeville, through which, with urine smells on the train platform and sour pickles down below, Alfred Kazin passed at the very outset of a walker in the city, where the cramped, redolent Jewish district drains with an intractable, damp sorrow into something more heterogeneous. Even some gypsies there, who might have predicted in one of their fortune-telling parlors a curtained hovel in a doorway with beads around the lamp, what an aching, ruinous, impoverished time all of it came to be. Baba's two-story house with its blistered yellow paint and flaking green windowsills, steps up the front stairs buckling, was actually on Howard Avenue, just off the bridge over the railroad, from the synagogue, across from the synagogue, a half block down from which was the playground of PS 28, the grammar school I went to. That's what they called it then, and taught it. Subject, predicate, object, maybe with faulty reference, the indeterminacy of they. But whether with they or there, we came upon the subjunctive with drills and penmanship, which also required a limber wrist for an exercise I liked, over, under, over, with fluent arcs of ink. To this day, instead of doodling, I'll sometimes practice that. Unlike Kazin, whom I came to know when I was directing at Lincoln Center, and we were both living in fine apartments on Upper Broadway, I was not particularly intimidated by the regimen at school. Merits and demerits, the seemingly incessant daily and weekly testing, midterms and finals, and the chastening record books, nor by the report cards that our parents had to sign with their uninflated double grades, one for conduct two, so that underneath an A, there might also be a D, which I was actually rather proud of when it did happen a couple of times. Nor did the teachers seem godlike or overbearing as they instructed us in good manners, good posture, good speech, or insisted we sit there in silence, good boys, good girls, hands clasped on the wooden desks as they diagrammed the sentence on the blackboard and the drill in grammar resumed. There were those who, despite the parse syntax and the devotion of teachers too, remained next to illiterate. But that was less so with the grandchildren of immigrants who still spoke mostly Yiddish, as if, with whatever misfortunes, we lived on the right side of the tracks, or at least at a fortunate distance, not from those that went under Atlantic Avenue, but from the L on Fulton Street. Two blocks over, three flights high, the trains clattered past the windows of anesthetized people there, very few Jewish, mostly Italians, the WOPs, and some potato Irish, who not only because of the trains hardly saw the light of day. But then, as my father saw it, there weren't many who did. In his cross-cultural judgment, not only confirmed by the news, but also his secret reading of Russian novelists, especially Dostoevsky, that was virtually the human condition. I'd always been under the impression that there was a lyric element in the name Brooklyn, having to do with a stream. As it was, however, the Dutch village of Brooklyn was named for its topography, and the name meant broken land, as if a proleptic vision. As it is now, the official geography is something other than what we took it to be, but the tracks over Fulton Street were the somewhat forbidding perimeter of what was, when I was born, on May 3rd, 1926, known simply as Bronzeville, without the prefix of Ocean Hill on the prior side of the hyphen. Since the nearest ocean I remember was off in Coney Island, which we reached by the Fulton L, with or without the nickel fare, often sneaking under the turnstiles or climbing up to the station, I still don't get the name. Actually, I never heard of Ocean Hill until many years later, after World War II and Vietnam, when the racial violence that broke out devastated what was already a ghetto as I grew up through the Depression, which I read about in the second chapter, the Depression itself. If that seemed to return with a vengeance, without any sort of new deal, there was no big deal. Bugsy Siegel got into the movies adapted for Warren Beatty. There was some last-ditch pillage by druggies who ripped off pipes and fixtures from the tenements along the street, selling the scrap metal that most of it really was to keep their habits going. Not long before he was killed, Bobby Kennedy apparently took up this blighted area as a cause, making it thus at last, in a sort of contrapuntal mockery of emergent affirmative action, fit to go into print. Last time I looked, however, more than a dozen years ago, the tenement in which we lived at 2110 Atlantic Avenue, near Saratoga, had all the windows cemented to keep the predators out, like a vertical field of gray tombstones, anonymous in the brick. I was actually born at 2182, corner of Rockaway, two big blocks over, none of the buildings spared, all ripped off, then sealed and ominous everywhere. Thus, when quite recently I wanted to go back again to stir up memory for this book, I was warned in no uncertain terms by Irving Frankel, my oldest friend from Brooklyn, living now off Madison Avenue in the fashion regime of New York. And then when I asked the police that even with a bodyguard, I'd better stay away. I was also thinking of returning to the nearby Bedford Stuy, whereupon somebody who lives there now, actually a black woman, a friend of a former student who, against his better judgment, felt he should go with me, said in a quaint phrasing, when he chickened and checked with her, about Bed-Stuy, think thrice. About Bronzeville, not at all. Just the day before, somebody came up behind a white guy and put a bullet in his head, apparently for no reason except the apparent reason. Had he still been alive, my father would have known. He could see it coming. But in this regard, so did most of those who lived there, including my brother, who became a plumber like my father and struggled through the Depression to his own construction business. As soon as they could afford it, they moved out to Long Island. The entire neighborhood, not only around the bridge, turned inexorably black, with every social impasse that went impossibly with that. Bobby Kennedy, notwithstanding, or for that matter, Rudy Cruz, the superintendent of schools, who brought 13 white and predominantly Jewish teachers back to the district, only to have them kicked out by black activists wanting to maintain local control. Control what? My father would say. The scene, not yet abysmal. With the double dose shootings up, the needles, and the guns. Yet were he around, he'd probably go with the activists without expecting for a utopian instant very much turned for the better, as indeed there hasn't been. As for my Polish grandmother, born in Krakow, who'd be a saint if Jews had saints, even as the warnings were warranted, dear Baba wouldn't move, not so long as the synagogue was there. When my parents had a telephone installed in her kitchen so she could call if anything happened, they worried that she wouldn't use it. Tell her, Joe, my mother would say in utter exasperation. And when my father insisted it was dangerous after the Schwarzes broke in and stole things from her house, not once but twice she said so, they need it, and stayed there with my crazy Aunt Rosie living above her till the night she died. Something about my crazy Aunt Rosie also in the second chapter. At the time of that last trip to the neighborhood, my wife and I were staying in Greenwich Village for the several weeks of a seminar I was giving at NYU. I may have been talking about Brooklyn when Kathy, a Shiksa from Wheaton, Illinois, just outside of Chicago, who spent her teens in a New Jersey suburb, said she wanted to see where I grew up. So I called my brother out in Long Island, way out in Westbury, who by this time had done more than well enough in his business to have a new car every year, nothing but a Cadillac, and asked if he could drive us out there. Kathy wants to see where we grew up, I said. What does she want to do that for? He said, with a long, familiar, almost genetic inflection, not at all cynicism, too all-knowing for that, which almost brought me back. But when I told him not to give me a hard time, pick us up, he said he'd meet us at Junior's, a now-famous diner just over the Manhattan Bridge, where you can still get, it appears, the largest portion of cheesecake anywhere. We had some coffee, but skipped the cheesecake and waited for Sidney to come. When he pulled up in his white Cadillac and we got in, he rolled up all the windows, pushed the buttons down on the doors, and said, we're only going on the main streets. What there was elsewhere, hard to guess. But the main streets, like Atlantic Avenue itself, were a wasteland. Or on this block, or that corner, like parts of Berlin when I saw it, subsided into grimness not long after the Blitz. As for residents, there was nobody there as we drove, except for a little girl who was wandering who knows where, since there was, so far as we could see, no place to go. Tenement windows sealed, broken glass in the frame houses, walls battered in, some of them collapsed. Where could she possibly live? Only rarely when I lived there did I feel anything like that. I remember certain late afternoons just before dark, autumn turning to winter with the wind blowing at me with nobody on the street, and there was on Atlantic Avenue a sense of vast desolation. There was no reason for me to stay out, and I could have gone immediately in, except that I felt, forlorn as it was, some anomalous thrill of endurance. But what about that little girl? The only thing comparable I've ever seen was almost farther than far away, out in the red, deserted landscape of the Southwest, where driving through one time with the mesas out there above, I passed an Indian on a horse-drawn wagon moving in implacable, slow motion through what seemed like infinite space with no destination. Or so it seemed to me. Where could he possibly be going? Probably some cave up there, hidden out of sight. And so with a little girl, one of the back streets, some place we couldn't see. Kathy was devastated. She couldn't believe it, though I assured her that when we lived there, it wasn't quite like that. If today at best Ocean Hill Bronzeville is a sort of eerie DMZ, there was once with a cluster of sometimes dozing convivial women sitting on milk boxes on the sidewalk and somebody hitting two sewers in a game of stickball across the street, a semblance of community certified by seders and bar mitzvahs and over among the goyim, people going to church. As for the imminence of the cross-cultural, one could see on weekday evenings, fathers home from work, maybe more so when unemployed, some kid carrying a pail, even a Jewish kid, to an Italian bar on a corner to have it filled up with beer, thus acquiring expertise on how much foam there should be at the top. If that didn't exempt us from gang wars between Jews and Italians, and then Jews and blacks, there was, at least at our end of Bronzeville, a certain civility in the violence, by which I mean, though you might get hurt in a fistfight where somebody might pull a knife, or by water bags thrown from a roof, there were rarely gratuitous killings, no rapes, so far as I knew, though a gang bang